The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Hi, this is the Takeaway Podcast for Friday, September 30th, 2016. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe and give us a rating on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
קדש ומהר הבא, ועל מה הדברה תראותך, לימיר מלכותך, יצמח ומתנך, יקרב משיחך, וחייכון...
This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It is a somber moment in Israel today as leaders from around the world in Jerusalem pay their final respects to Shimon Peres, one of the last surviving founders of Israel and a player on its political stage for decades. Peres died this week at the age of 93.
What we are doing today is more than signing an agreement. It is a revolution. Yesterday, a dream. Today, a commitment.
That is Shimon Peres at the signing of the 1993 Oslo Peace Accords, signed on the White House lawn 23 years ago this month. That was a moment of hope that won the Nobel Peace Prize for Peres, Yasser Arafat of the PLO, and Yitzhak Rabin, Israel's prime minister. Peres, in that moment, glimpsed his dream of an Israel that would be part of a dynamic multiracial and multi-ethnic region, leading in education, prosperity, and justice in the Middle East. The story of the Oslo Peace Accords, spurred by a group of unlikely Norwegian diplomats, is a grand drama of history and human courage, and it is told in the successful play Oslo, coming to Broadway after a brilliant run at the Lincoln Center Mitzi Newhouse Theater here in New York. Oslo is written by playwright J.T. Rogers, who met Shimon Peres as he was writing his play and very much wanted Peres to see it. Oslo captures the hope that seemed always just out of reach for the Israeli leader.
I think he, like everyone that I talked to who was involved in the Oslo process, they all are passionate, or in his case, were passionate about the story details of that event being constantly sent out in the world as, in some ways, these are my words, not his, but a bulwark against the world we're living in now. And we live in a time now where the idea of compromise between governments, between people, is now looked on as foolish, even weak, dangerous. And here's an event, and from the Israeli side, an architect of that event, who believe the opposite, who believe that no matter how awful things are, you must look at your enemy. When I was working on the play, and a lot as I would think about Peres as I was writing it, I had among many quotes on my wall where I was writing the Roman playwright Terence from 2,000 years ago, who said, anything that is human is not alien to me. And that's what I found so remarkable about the Oslo process and about Peres himself, is that they were willing to say, yes, you are my enemy, and we have personally or collectively called for your blood, and yet I must see you as a human being, and I must know you. And that is extraordinary, I think, both theatrically and in life.
Did you sense that quality when you met him?
Well, on top of everything else, he was a consummate politician. So like an actor or a politician, there was always a sense of a slight presentation of the self that you wanted the world to know.
Mm.
But I did adore the fact that when I met him, I was ushered into this enormous ballroom in a swank hotel on the Upper East Side with security everywhere. He was there for a UN event. And there was no one in the entire restaurant but he at the far end of an enormous table that could set up 8. And I'm brought slowly, myself and director Bart Scheer, to sit before him. And a waiter comes in very quietly, who obviously knows what the great man wants, and sets an enormous goblet of red wine and just steps back. And he just touches it, has a sip, puts it down, a moment that I put in the play. And then we just talk for a little bit.
Did he see Oslo? Did he see this play? Was he going to?
He was scheduled to come. I had been speaking at great length with his staff. They let him know that he had been told by diplomats around the world who had seen it, oh, you must see it. You're in it. You'll like that. It's true in its essence to what happened. So we had worked out this very elaborate plan for him to come. And then as plans became clear, they were going to move to a larger venue in a Broadway run this spring. My idea was come, see the matinee, and then speak to 1,000 people about your experience of seeing the play and then what it was really like. And now he's left us. Mm. And I will have wished that I had that experience.
It seems in thinking about that time and that period of peacemaking being so at hand and possible, that the cast of characters, the whole repertory company of people who might have made peace in the Middle East is gone.
The people that we know now are gone. But there are always people that are pushing for peace. They're often derided. I mean, it's got to be a lonely, lonely place to be in Israel right now to hold those points of view, just the way it's been incredibly lonely in our country at certain points. The first thing I thought when I read that he had died was one of the many magnificent phrases that he'd sort of sprinkled across literature and politics in his life. And the one that came to mind was, there are two things you should never do in public, make love or make peace. And I think as controversial as the Oslo Accords were and still are, I think his life and what they achieved is proof positive that there you must sit away from the cameras, away from prying eyes, and get to know those who you are supposed to hate. I mean, I only pray that the Democratic Party and the National Rifle Association are sitting in a room somewhere quietly, a representative from each, talking slowly, laboriously about, well, what could we agree on? Part of me fears that's living in the climate we have now where to compromise is almost evil on all sides. That may not be happening, but the Oslo process and the life of Shimon Peres, to me, shows that that is a necessity.
I interviewed Shimon Peres a number of times and also saw him speak. He loved to speak to young people, and he would always tell them, go into politics. It's something you must do. It's what we need, young people in politics. I think you've got a sense of his loneliness, not being absolutely assured that there were folks behind him committed to doing what he wanted to do.
I think that actual optimism in the face of tragedy, knowing how tragic and brutal and awful the world is, yet refusing to accept that that is the end of everything, is it's extraordinary. It is, as I said, Shakespearean and almost Greek in his view and his push to go on. I can't go on. I must go on.
J.T. Rogers is the author of the play Oslo, moving to the Vivian Beaumont Theater on Broadway here in New York City. Thank you.
My great pleasure.
A grand moment of history is passing this weekend in the nation of Colombia. The government of Colombia and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, known as FARC, have signed a peace agreement that puts an end to the five-decade war that has claimed more than 200,000 lives. But the agreement for now is only symbolic. It will become official or will be rejected after Colombians vote on a crucial referendum this Sunday. Nadia Drost is a Bogota-based reporter on assignment for the PBS NewsHour. She was at the peace signing on Monday and has been traveling the country this week, tracking the reaction and anticipation of voters all over the nation of Colombia. Nadia, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hello, thank you.
How important is this milestone for Colombia moving away from something that's really, for decades, dogged the politics and identity of this nation?
Well, actually, it really feels like it's everything right now. I think that a lot of people have, from outside of Colombia, have seen that it's been an interesting and perhaps unusual move for President Santos to call these peace agreements into question and using a national plebiscite or referendum. But he has always said that he has wanted to get the confidence and support from the public. And that would help ensure that these peace agreements are implemented when his presidency ends and whoever replaces him in the future. So I think that it's kind of a very important moment for Colombians to take stock of what the past 4 years of negotiations in Cuba have come to and to really decide, do they want peace to happen? Do they want this war to end? But ultimately, the real question is, are they willing to pay the costs for peace? Because, of course, this peace agreement is not perfect. For most Colombians, there are shortfalls. And the question that a lot of people are asking themselves is, am I willing to accept the peace agreement as it is and live with whatever shortfalls it has?
Is there any chance that this is a high stakes, gambit that will turn out like the Brexit vote in the UK?
Well, right now, polls are showing that the yes side, which is the campaign that votes in favor of accepting the peace agreements, are comfortably ahead. However, there is a significant population in Colombia that still has not decided how they're going to vote, if they're going to vote in favor or rejection of the peace agreements. And so that population is in limbo right now and may possibly swing the vote.
If this vote is a mandate, an overwhelming yes on Sunday, what will Colombians be able to do, think about as far as the future goes, that they haven't been able to think about in the past?
I think if these peace agreements are implemented, I think that Colombians will be able to start thinking about parts of their life that one might not think is, you know, inextricably linked with conflict necessarily. These peace agreements are very wide-ranging. They don't necessarily just touch on issues of hostilities between parties and disarmament. They deal with a lot of the root causes of the conflict and work on trying to improve rural development and address a lot of the inequalities that are both a root cause as well as a consequence of the conflict. So a lot of Colombians are seeing these peace agreements not simply as a way for warring parties to put down arms and cease hostilities, but rather a milestone into a different possible era for Colombia where a lot of those inequalities are addressed.
Are there individuals in Colombia who are bitter about this being viewed as an amnesty for the FARC, the armed militants?
Absolutely. There is a significant population in Colombia which sees that this peace agreement is a way of handing over amnesties that are not necessarily deserved to the FARC. This sentiment has largely been led by ex-president Alvaro Uribe, who has been leading the campaign of no to reject the peace accords. And some of the kind of touchstone issues that the no campaign has really been focusing on is this idea that the peace agreements are not harsh enough for the FARC, that they do not adequately address the atrocities that many FARC members and the organization as a whole has committed. The problem is that both the FARC and the government have said that if this referendum fails, there is no way that they will return to the negotiating table.
Nadia Drost is a Bogota-based reporter on assignment for the PBS NewsHour. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
You know, long before Donald Trump made known his political aspirations, he'd already won numerous awards. He was a legend, named to the 1995 Gaming Hall of Fame. He's in the Boxing Hall of Fame, the 2010 New York Ride of Fame, honorary doctorates from Robert Gordon and Liberty Universities. World Wrestling Entertainment has put him in the WWE Hall of Fame. He's won two Emmys, and long ago, he made the list of the 10 most embarrassing New Yorkers compiled by the satirical Spy magazine, founded by Kurt Anderson and E. Graydon Carter. The very first issue of the magazine aimed at poking fun at the rich and powerful, and Donald was right there. Kurt Anderson now hosts Studio 360 on WNYC and PRI. He's put together a special hour where he and his guests, like Susan Morrison and Lawrence O'Donnell, examine the storied legendary resume of Donald Trump and what it says about America's divided vision of politics and entertainment.
It's been changing slowly. It's the old frog in the slowly boiling pot. We in our Studio 360 hour start with television and John F. Kennedy. And once being president became a television performance, that kind of changed everything. And Kennedy obviously was this American Cary Grant. And of course, there was a feature film in theaters while he was president celebrating his war heroism. Obviously, Ronald Reagan, once we elected an actor president who understood that running for and being president was a performance, we went a little further. Meanwhile, in between, we had Richard Nixon saying, "Talk it to me" on Laugh-In.
That's right.
In 1968. And
that's
which was an amazing moment.
It was a big moment. It was.
And who was the guru of Richard Nixon's television campaign?
Roger Ailes. That's right.
He's always there. And then candidate after candidate appearing as themselves in sketches on Saturday Night Live. the merger just kept happening and kept happening.
So by the time Trump comes to the campaign, all of his huge resume of entertainment moments, plus the names that you called him even,
yes,
emerged straight into the campaign.
Here's a little list of some of the other things we called him, which I think are kind of fantastic. Well-fed condo hustler. Ugly cufflink buff.
We actually said these?
Yeah. Shuttle-owning dilettante megalomaniac. This is my favorite. Joyless punk millionaire. Forbes 400 dropout. Aren't they good?
Those are good.
And short-fingered vulgarian, the one you coined, is the one that survived.
That's the one we finally stuck with and kept repeating. Part of the comedy of that was just repeating it. Every time we mentioned Donald Trump in the magazine, on first mention, we had to say short-fingered vulgarian Donald Trump. And then, crazily, like my personal world historical acid flashback, it becomes a phrase and concept, his short fingers and small hands in this campaign.
So is it an I told you so moment for you? Is it a certainly the humor shows have made lots of hay out of Trump, but there's a serious point to all of looking at this.
Well, there is. It's not an I told you so at all. I mean, I guess I'm happy that we, you know, saw this grotesque clown for what he was early on. But no, I think the fact that he may be elected our president is an extraordinary thing to me. And what we're looking at in this hour and what I think is important, in addition to the politics that gave us Trump and Trumpism and the economics that gave us Trump and Trumpism, there is this cultural thing that we have all been part of. Like, oh, it's all a joke. It's all fun. You know, news is entertainment. Entertainment can be news. Politics can be show business. It's been happening for a while. It didn't just happen. America have been softening up our ground to enable this to happen.
You know, I don't want to sound sanctimonious here.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah. There was a point where I kind of stopped laughing at all of this. I feel like there's something deeper going on that we have to focus on, and I'm wondering if that's part of your mission here.
I mean, it is part of my feeling, certainly. And, you know, I was never of the opinion that, oh, this is a joke, this can't happen, and let's not take him seriously as a result. I really thought that he picked his moment well. You know, he had flirted with running several times, but in his lizard brain genius way, understood that this was the moment when he could bring his particular kind of demagoguery to a large audience in this entertaining way by breaking through the politeness and decorum of ordinary politicians.
You talk in the program about Saturday Night Live and Comedy Central. Certainly they're entertaining, but do they also provide a door that entertainment is an access point for a group in the audience that aren't politically sophisticated or even interested in politics, but they can bond with a candidate through entertainment where they couldn't watching a congressional hearing?
Yeah, and the fact that, you know, people, and especially younger people, have gotten a lot of their news from Colbert Report and Daily Show, you don't want to condemn everything that isn't Walter Cronkite 1966 forms of broadcast political journalism. But, you know, it is certainly part of the merger I'm talking about where, you know, Lindsey Graham and Barack Obama and various presidents and Bushes and
Mitt Romney
go on these shows and show that they have a sense of humor about themselves. I get why that's necessary, but it is symptomatic of this merger that has also given us Donald Trump.
Can I ask you kind of a gut question?
Yes.
Here? I can't resist because of your spy background.
Yeah.
Of the kinds of characters in the 80s in New York, which of these, besides Donald Trump, would you have more loved to see in the political realm? Let me give you a list, okay?
Okay.
There's Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Okay. There's Leona Helmsley.
Yeah.
There's the Ramones.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I don't think we never attacked them.
But they were back then. They were in play. And Crazy Eddie.
You know, it is as if the Ramones and Crazy Eddie were managing a campaign. but of course, back then, also in Spy, we did a whole feature about Paul Manafort, until recently Trump's main man. We did a whole feature about Rudy Giuliani, now Trump's monstrous main man, whom I once voted for. So the fact that, you know, Spy, what it did in the late 80s and early 90s, that those figures from Trump on down are very much in play, while, alas, Spy is not, for now, is ironic at the very least.
Spy is not. But Kurt Anderson is, ahead of his time, writer, host, and co-creator of Studio 360 on WNYC and PRI. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
You can listen to the full episode on your public radio station or subscribe to the Studio 360 podcast on iTunes or anywhere you get your podcasts. By the way, early this morning, Donald Trump felt the need to tweet about Miss Universe winner Alicia Machado. Did Hillary Clinton make her a citizen so she could go after him in the campaign, he accused. Check out sex tape and past, he tweeted. Hillary floated her as an angel without checking her past. Here's a tweet I thought of, Mr. Trump. Put down the iPhone. Go back to sleep.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Trust. You are now on the inside of what I like to call circle of trust.
You want me to trust you? Don't use big words you don't understand.
News consumers have gone into their corners.
It's time for who do you trust? Hubba, hubba, hubba. Money, money, money. Who do you trust?
What we have to begin to do is look to ourselves.
I've given up lying and trusting.
Trust in me.
Got trust? What is this impulse to trust? Well, this week we've spoken about the military and the media trusting bankers and the water we drink as things that require trust to function. Most of the time, when we talk about trust, we're talking about this.
Your request. Dedications. Stories from the heart. That's what you'll find each night right here. We talk to you. We listen to you. Sometimes we get a little personal and pry into your business, and we try to find the perfect song to weave into your story to touch your heart. Welcome aboard.
Stories of love and trust, loss and betrayal, they are the mainstay of radio personality Delilah, who counsels and consoles 8 million weekly listeners. A single mom with 13 kids, 10 adopted, living in the Pacific Northwest, she's been married 4 times, divorced 3. Delilah says she's on a lifelong journey to a place of trust, and each night she invites her listeners to join her. And they do.
When you are betrayed in infancy and childhood by the people that should be protecting you, but instead abuse you, exploit you, molest you, rape you, whatever, that betrayal is nearly impossible to heal from.
And is that what you've learned from your listeners, or is that what you've learned in your life?
That's definitely a life lesson. I have 10 adopted children, and I work with foster kids a lot. I have an NGO that works with foster kids. And, you know, these are kids who have been betrayed on the deepest level. And when you cannot form trust in those first few years of life, it's very hard to trust anything in the world. People who are raised in healthy environments where trust is a given rarely are attracted to somebody who is that deceitful because they recognize it for what it is.
People call you, and a lot of people say that, well, the reason that they talk to you is that there's something about you that makes people trust you. But are they trusting you, or are they just need someone to listen?
In this world where we've got all this digital connectivity, there is a greater need than ever for honest communication. And people are hungry to feel like they belong. They're hungry to feel connected. And so, yeah, they do need someone to listen. But my regular listeners who are a part of the show have listened to me long enough that they know I'm for real. You know, I'm not pretending to be something I'm not.
Have you ever, you know, had someone trust you and you realized that you let them down either with the wrong advice or a mistake that you'd made and just what that felt like?
Oh, yeah, of course, especially as a parent. You know, there's nothing that hurts worse than realizing that you have betrayed your children or that a decision you made has hurt them or impacted them negatively. And I'm human. You know, I've done that. In our culture, we are so centered on me, what I want, what feels good to me. And when you've got that attitude, when you having a bottle of wine at night is more important than you sitting there and doing your homework with your kids, you're betraying your children.
Is Delilah your real name?
It is. My parents had a bizarre sense of humor, and my maiden name is Luke, and my brother's name before he passed was Matthew Mark Luke. So they decided to counteract the good with Delilah.
Well, as long as it wasn't Samson. Do you ever feel sometimes on your show that people maybe trust you too much? You know, trust is
no,
this
because
very...
I tell people all the time, listen, honey, your problem cannot be solved in the 3-minute Delilah dilemma. You need to, number one, find a really good counselor. And number two, find some really good girlfriends that you can talk to. And, you know, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a psychologist. And a lot of issues need to be dealt with long term and in an environment with somebody who's a professional, because some people do need medication. Some people do need hospitalization. If you're calling me in crisis, I am not going to pretend like I have all the answers. No. But people know when they call me, if they get through to me and if I talk to them, I'm going to respect them and listen to them and give them wisdom from my heart, not from a book, but from my experiences.
Who betrayed you the worst in your life?
My first husband was an alcoholic and a sex addict who cheated on me a number of times. And that betrayal did a number on me for years and years. But that said, I was the one that kept going back. If somebody shows you by their actions that they're not to be trusted, believe them.
Right.
Don't think you're going to change them, because you're not.
You're not married now, are you?
I am.
You are married now. Okay.
I am again.
I was thinking.
Ask me. But we do live in different states, and that makes it much easier.
How do you trust?
Because
how do you trust that things are going on?
That's funny you asked that, because I was at a store shopping with my kids and some friends' kids. So I had like 10 kids running around the store, and the lady at the dressing room was talking to me, and she said, "I don't recognize your kids. I thought I knew everybody in this little town." And I said, "Well, you probably know my husband." And I told her his name. She goes, "Oh yeah, I know him, but who are these kids and stuff?" And so I explained our dynamics, and her eyes shot wide open. She goes, "You let a man that handsome live away from you?" And I said, "Yes. He's not a dog on a leash. He's a human." And she said, "Well, how do you trust him?" And I said, "Honey, I would not have put myself in this marriage, in this relationship, if there were anything in his character that indicated he wasn't trustworthy." I said, "If you don't have trust as the essence and the foundation of your marriage or your union, you don't have anything."
Delilah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Delilah is a syndicated radio personality, author, and songwriter. To hear more from our series, Got Trust, Exploring Faith and Suspicion in the 21st Century, just visit thetakeaway.org/trust.
Hi, this is Chris Dawson from Vashon Island, Washington, and the only public figure I trust for advice is Dan Savage. Straight talk, no pun intended, and zero pandering to anyone. Gotta love the guy.
My name is Judy from Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Oprah makes me feel better because she's just so human. She's just so humble. One reason I appreciate Oprah is that she publicly bowed her weight in so many ways.
Join in on the conversation. Leave us a comment on thetakeaway.org or find us on Twitter at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I just want to tell you all how happy I am to be back in the studio making a picture again.
It was a bilious piece of dirt that made me cry out in pain.
Did you say it was a brilliant piece of work and you'll fly me out to Spain?
I've seen The Exorcist about 167 times, and it keeps getting funnier every single time I see it.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and it's Friday movie time with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Hey, Rafer.
Hi, John.
So we've got very different offerings this weekend. I think it's kind of interesting. Deepwater Horizon is the first movie we're going to take a look at. directed by the same guy who did The Last Survivor.
Lone Survivor. And Battleship.
And Battleship, right. This is about the Deepwater Horizon, the drilling rig in the
Gulf of Mexico.
That exploded and nobody survived. So.
No, people survived, but it did kill 11 people, and of course there was the environmental cost as well. Mark Wahlberg plays one of the an electrician who was on the rig when it exploded.
Mike, what is that? Is everything okay?
Mike.
I'm going back.
Is this about disaster realism, drama, technology, the environment, what?
Well, it's not really about the environment, I wouldn't say, but it's definitely about spectacle. You know, I'm not a big fan of Peter Berg, but this is a very well-made disaster film. It's very gripping. You know, the build-up to the explosion is very tense, and once that thing blows, it does so with a vengeance. I mean, you know, it's quite a sight to see.
And we don't know much about these drilling rigs. I mean, people are kind of meeting this visually for the first time, just the size and scale of these huge things.
And the movie does a very good job of taking you onto that rig. You really feel the oil. You feel the sweat. I guess my big question is it okay to make just a spectacular piece of entertainment about the Deepwater Horizon disaster? I don't know, but it does work as a movie.
It was the worst oil spill in the history of the world, that's for sure.
That's right.
Movie number two, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. Only Tim Burton could come up with a title like that.
Peculiars have been persecuted through the ages. Hence, we live in places like this. I'm a type of peculiar called an Imrine.
Yeah, you turn into a bird.
Well, I do. Yes, but that's not very useful. An Imbrine's main skill is the manipulation of time. We choose a safe place, a safe day, and create a loop.
What do you mean?
Well, a loop preserves the last 24 hours. Reset the loop, and the day is yours to live in again. Reset it daily, and you can stay there forever.
Now, this seems like another autobiographical Tim Burton movie.
Yeah, well, it certainly gets to his love for Universal monster movies and sort of the macabre. You know, all the peculiar children in this home have these kind of deformities or superpowers. They have, you know, one has a mouth on the back of her neck. Another one can project his dreams. One has bees inside his lungs. So there are all these very strange creatures. As you heard there, a lot of exposition, and I'm not really sure what time travel has to do with these peculiar children. There are also some monsters called the Hollows, which is short for Holocaust, which seems like sort of a weighty metaphor to drop into the middle of this kid's film. So I love
Burton, but what did you think?
Well, I'm very hit and miss on Burton, and this sort of indulges his visual sense, and it's very arresting in that sense. But to me, it was a lot of talk, a lot of complicated story that didn't really go anywhere, and I don't think you can really connect with these characters, and that I thought was a problem for me.
Does Samuel L. Jackson steal the movie?
He does his best. He plays a mad scientist. He gets some good lines in the film.
Finally, The Dressmaker, Jocelyn Moorhouse, Kate Winslet, Judy Davis, Liam Hemsworth.
Yeah, this is based on a novel. I'll try to make this short. It's about a woman who left her hometown as a child. She was accused of killing another child, but she has no memory of it. Now she's become a high-end seamstress in the fashion industry, and she's returning home to try and solve the mystery. If you can buy that kind of weird plot, you might enjoy it. It's a very uneven, very strange film, but for the most part, entertaining.
C's from Rafer Guzman, although maybe a D for Tim Burton. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
President Barack Obama, curator-in-chief.
Come on, baby, don't you want to go?
President singing with Buddy Guy, Mick Jagger, and B.B. King. He's made the White House home to a wide diversity of artists and performers in his two terms.
The smile on your face lets me know that you need me.
The world is gonna know your name. What's your name, man?
Alexander Hamilton. His name is Alexander Hamilton.
There's Esperanza Spalding, Alison Krauss, Awadochin Pratt, Lin-Manuel Miranda. On Monday, the cultural festival bursts outside with South by South Lawn, Obama's homage to Austin's South by Southwest. Our culture reporter Melissa Locker says this is big. This is legacy stuff.
President Obama has had pretty much impeccable musical taste
I think he's going to have an incredible cultural legacy. Not only does South by Southlawn have film and art, but it also has a music component. And he's invited two bands, the Lumineers and Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, to perform. And the Lumineers are kind of a folksy Americana rock band from, I think, Denver.
Let's listen to the Lumineers' Ophelia.
Oh, Ophelia, you've been on my mind, girl, since the flood. Oh, Ophelia, heaven help a fool.
And Sharon Jones, I don't know if you've heard her, but she is, she's a powerhouse.
Retreat, hell have no fury like a woman scorned.
Retreat,
retreat, retreat, yeah. I'll make you wish that you was never, ever born.
Retreat.
I profiled her for Brooklyn Magazine about a month ago, and she is just such an incredible woman. She's currently battling cancer, and she's going to be up on stage performing for the White House and for the president. So far, he's only announced two artists and also a DJ, Beverly Bond, who founded Black Girls Rock. Might be more coming, but they haven't announced them yet. And this, of course, is just a sample of President Obama's impeccable musical taste. He has been putting out playlists for a few years, and every time that he drops a playlist, you're like, how does he even know about these bands? It's kind of incredible that, I'm sure it's like an intern, but who knows? Maybe it's really him.
Maybe not. I mean, you could say it's like a committee of millennials that's in the White House, but you get the sense that he's not just a nostalgia buff. He's up to speed on music, and he's got those two teenage daughters, right?
That's true. That's true. And if you look at his playlist, there's a good possibility that his daughters were involved. Last summer, he put out a playlist that included like Common and Nas and Gary Clark Jr., as well as some classics like Charles Mingus and Billie Holiday.
So do you think this tradition is likely to be continued by whoever makes it into the White House next year?
Possibly. I mean, it's hard, like with Hillary Clinton's willingness to do things like go on between two ferns, it seems likely that she'd continue the tradition. Yeah. And it'd be fun to see what music she would choose. She already has her playlists that she's been using on the campaign trail. And I think you can see artists like Beyonce showing up. If you're the first female president, you're going to go full Beyonce. At least I would.
Girl, run the world.
And Donald Trump?
Donald Trump is very, very particular about his musical taste. He chooses a lot of the music that he plays on the campaign trail. And the problem that Donald Trump keeps running into is that a lot of artists don't want him to use their music. But, you know, there's certain artists like Elton John, for instance, who sort of shrug.
He's a person with an extraordinarily rich hair narrative like Donald Trump.
That is very true. They have that going for them. And so, yeah, maybe Elton John would come out and perform at South by Southlawn in a Donald Trump presidency.
Is Elton John down with Trump using Tiny Dancer?
I don't think Elton John is particularly like interested in supporting Trump, but he hasn't really come out forcefully and said, please stop playing my music, like a lot of other acts like Queen and Bruce Springsteen have told him.
So we've got just a few months to go before Obama leaves office. Do you think he'll try to do like a little mini Burning Man on the White House lawn?
That would be amazing. And hopefully I would get an invitation to that one.
Melissa Locker, the cultural correspondent for The Takeaway, who also reports for Time, The Guardian, and Brooklyn Magazine, we learned.
Yeah.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, John.
If you have the chance to work with editor Robert Gottlieb, here's some advice. Be careful about using the L word. Legend. Is one of the most successful editors in the history of publishing intimidating?
I think of myself as a guy who lucked into a wonderful job and was good enough at it to be successful, but I do not see myself as a legend. Obviously, only an idiot would. I couldn't imagine anyone being afraid of me. Why would anybody be afraid of me? But there it was. But he got over it.
You might get a different answer from some of the many authors Robert Gottlieb has worked with in his more than 60 years as a book editor. He helped give birth to such classics as Catch-22, Beloved, the works of Michael Crichton, John le Carré, Ray Bradbury, Doris Lessing, and Robert Carroll, among others. His career began at Simon & Schuster in the 1950s, continued at Alfred A. Knopf, where he served as president and editor-in-chief before he succeeded William Shawn as editor of the New Yorker magazine in the late 1980s. Today, Gottlieb is still working closely with historian Robert Caro to complete the fifth volume in his monumental biography of President Lyndon Johnson. And always, always, Gottlieb's always reading.
everywhere. I read everywhere and all the time. And if there isn't a book to read, I'll read a magazine. If there isn't a magazine, I'll read a newspaper. If there isn't a newspaper, I'll read, I don't know, the back of a cereal box.
Are you one of these folks who, when you travel, there's a separate suitcase full of books, or do you just do one at a time?
Well, first of all, there's the preparation. So the question starts in my mind, what am I taking with me? I'm not thinking about clothes, or which I don't have many, and I've got them in various places anyway. No, no, it's what books am I going to read that month? And then there's my Kindle. So if you've got your Kindle stacked with the great writers whom you admire of the past, you're really secure. If you have all of Balzac and all of Henry James and all of Dickens, you know, at a fingertip distance, you're not going to languish.
Toni Morrison,
mm-hmm.
She carries herself as very much a voice of history in America, but you just looked at it as a story.
Well, you know, Toni and I are exactly the same age with the same reading background. So we melded or melted or whatever the word should be. So with her second book, Sula, I started to edit her, and I'm still editing her. She sent me 40, 50 pages the other day of her newest book.
Worst argument you ever had with Toni Morrison?
I never had an argument
never.
With Toni. The only thing we ever disagree about is commas. And
you want more? She wants less?
I want commas where they belong. She doesn't always. And I finally figured out why. Because when she's reading, and I assume when she's writing, she hears what she's saying. Well, if you hear it, you don't need punctuation because it's punctuated in your head. But if you're reading it without the benefit of her voice, sometimes it's a stopper. So it's a joke between us. It's just one of our jokes. And I think she says we give each other one. You can have this one, but you can't have that one.
For my taste, there's miraculous books like Catch-22, mm-hmm. where for me, reading that book was, I can't believe I'm experiencing this as I'm reading it. Did you have that feeling just coming upon the manuscript, or did it have to be whacked into shape?
Well, between the time I first saw material to the time there was a complete manuscript, it was like 4 or 5 years. Oh, it had an immense amount of work. Joe was, first of all the writers I've worked with, he had the best editorial mind. Now, he knew that he had written an important book. He knew it before anyone else knew it, including me. But when dealing with it, we would sit like two surgeons working on the same patient. You know, this phrase isn't working. Right. What if we do this? No, better here. Then we'd have to do this. Exactly. But we put that there. And that dialogue could have been either of us talking in either role. He was completely clear and fine. Even when at the last moment, soon before it went to press, I said to him, you know, there's a chapter in here I've never liked. The tone doesn't work for me with the rest of the book. He said, drop it. That was the discussion.
Wow. Did you think that Catch-22 would become part of the language?
See, I don't think that way.
Yeah.
I just do the job that's in front of me.
Does it amaze you that it is part of the language, that everyone...
Well, you know, it doesn't amaze me in this sense. There are certain words or phrases that the language or the world needs, and then they come along and they become embedded in the language. Here's another one. You know, we all say something is Kafkaesque. Well, we didn't have that word before. There was a Kafka. But the moment we had it, we needed it. And Catch-22 worked for that and for us.
That was the title from the beginning?
No, it was Catch-18. And we had to change the number. That was utterly hilarious because... As we were approaching publication in 1961, we read Publishers Weekly that Leon Uris, whose novel Exodus had been one of the phenomenal successes of our time, had a new book coming out also about the war called Mila 18, and so we needed a new number. So there was a great deal of agitation about what number to pick. And one night I was lying in bed sleepless over this monumental, world-shattering problem. And the number 22 crossed my mind. And I called him in the morning and I said, I've got it. I've got it. 22. It's even funnier than 18. This, of course, was delusionary because no number is funnier than any other number. But we needed a number. So we settled on that one.
Oh, what's next for you Mr. Gottlieb, before we dismiss you?
Well, I'm still a functioning editor.
Yeah.
I'm 85, but my mind seems to be working away. This book came along. I didn't want to write it. I decided I would write it. It's over.
Who's your editor? Some terrified person who...
Oh, Farrah Straus, Eileen Smith. I enjoy that process because it's about language. It's about words. It's about ideas. So I love being... The first time somebody edited me, I remember, I will name no names, he was in absolute mortal terror. Why would anybody be afraid of me? But there it was. But he got over it. And anyone gets over it because, you know, I'm talky, I'm jokey, I'm relaxed, because what's there not to be relaxed about? The fate of the universe is not involved here.
Trump.
Trump. Isn't he divine? First of all, he's given us all something to talk about. And it's not so bad to live in trepidation and terror, lest the worst happen, which I do not believe it will. You know, I knew Hillary when I was working with Bill.
Right.
I didn't know her well. But I could see why she would be a good president now that I look back. Didn't occur to me then, of course. She was organized. She was smart. She was responsive. She knew how to do it. Now, Bill knew how to do it because it was in him. Everything about him came right out, you know. With her, I felt more she had learned how to do it, but she had learned it well, and she enjoyed knowing it.
Robert Gottlieb, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Robert Gottlieb is former president, publisher, and editor-in-chief of Alfred A. Knopf and the former editor of The New Yorker. His memoir, Avid Reader, is out now. To hear an extended version of my conversation with Mr. Gottlieb, visit thetakeaway.org. And here's something to take with you today. The magical power of writing. A struggling guy in suburban Chicago one time entered a contest to compose a jingle, and as he was bereft of ideas, recalled that his wild son had once said he, quote, wished he was a dirt bike hot dog. And the inspiration changed the world.
Oh, I'd love to be an Oscar Mayer wiener. That is what I truly like to be. 'Cause if I were an Oscar Mayer wiener, everyone would be in love with me.
Richard Trentledge wrote the Oscar Mayer jingle, and it made him a millionaire. He died this week at the age of 87. Don't blame me if you can't get that song out of your head all weekend. Billions of people know that tune. Wish I were an Oscar Mayer wiener. Have a great weekend. That's all for us today. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.